A subject of widespread discussion and debate among the American people concerns whether we should adopt some form of compulsory health insurance, such as the one which currently has its advocates in the National Congress. Earlier today, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt in the Colonial Room of the Park Sheraton Hotel, New York City, was hostess to a group of men and women, among whom were several who, either as doctors or legislators, were well qualified to present differing points of view concerning a national health program. Their discussion was presented by NBC Television, and here, transcribed as she introduced her guest, is the voice of the distinguished American citizen and representative to the United Nations, Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt.
This is a program to give an opportunity to many people to say what they think and why. And now I'd like to introduce my guests, Senator Murray of Montana and Dr. Conlin of the American Medical Association, who comes to us from Boston. First of all, I'd like to ask Senator Murray if he would tell us his point of view on a bill that he has in Congress, because today we are discussing the controversial subject of the way to have medical care.
Thank you, Mrs. Roosevelt. All of us, indeed I may include the entire world, are fully aware of your devotion to human welfare. I was one of the original sponsors of a health insurance program in this country. Many years ago, with Senator Wagner of New York, I introduced the first bill which provided for a voluntary insurance system. That system was severely attacked and criticized. At one time, the American Medical Association took the view that a voluntary system would never work, and that if we were to have any kind of a system, it would have to be compulsory. After much study, we introduced a compulsory system bill. It required a great deal of care and pains to work out a bill of that character. We knew it wouldn't be perfect when we first introduced it. We called upon the American medical profession to come in and sit down with us and help us to work out that bill. But we didn't get any support from them. Instead, they raised enormous funds to carry on a program of misrepresentation. And I'm very glad to be here today to have the opportunity before the millions that will be listening here today to nail a despicable lie, which is that this is a socialism, that it is socialized medicine. That is absolutely untrue. We, the sponsors of this bill, are all opposed to socialism in this country. We're opposed to socialized medicine. They may have a system of that kind in England that's being talked about a great deal. They claim over there that it is very satisfactory. That's all right. They can have any system they wish, but we don't want any of it in this country. We want a purely American system, a system by insurance, which has met other problems that have been of great importance to the people in this country. We met the problem, for instance, of saving the money of depositors in the banks of the United States by a compulsory system of insurance. The people now get less interest on their money in the banks, but their deposits are insured, and when they come around to draw out their money, they get it. We want that same kind of a system applied to the health of the American people. We want them to have the best health. We've got the best medical system in the world here in the United States, and we want it available to all the people, and the only way that can be done is by an insurance system such as we have proposed. Now, I don't want to take up too much time in discussing this program of ours, but I think that it is well understood. It's been discussed now over the radio on many, many occasions. We've had many hearings on it, but the misrepresentation still persists that this is socialized medicine. They also refer to it as regimentation of the American medical profession. There's no such thing as a regimentation of the medical profession. The medical profession will practice medicine in exactly the same way they have always practiced it under this bill. It'll be under the control of the people and the doctors in the various communities of the country. We'll set up standards in Washington, but outside of that, it'll be completely under the control of the doctors.
Well, that's very interesting, but now I'd like to hear from Dr. Conlin, who represents an opposing point of view.
Thank you, Mrs. Roosevelt. First, who is this American Medical Association? I am proud to be both a member and a fellow of a group of 140,000 American physicians who are over 90% opposed to an administrative compulsory tax sickness program. In my own state of Massachusetts, an adequate sample and survey showed that over 95% of our physicians on a confidential poll protecting the identity of the voters showed that percentage of our physicians in opposition. We are in favor of a program which will safeguard the voluntary way, the freedom of the individual, and particularly the responsibility of the individual. If we analyze medical care, we'll find from figures from the Department of Commerce that average expenditure by families for health is about $168 on the most recently available figures. This sounds like quite a blow for a low-income family, say $1,500. However, we find the major impact is on 25% of our families. Those are the families which have sickness, hospitalized illness in the course of a year, or surgery. For all people, the average basic expense figures out about $75 divided evenly between the physician outside of the hospital, the dentist, and all other purposes. The 25% of families who have unpredictable and catastrophic illness are the group that we're anxious to take care of. The wealthy, I think we can exclude from the discussion. The indigent, I think we can exclude. How best are we going to meet this problem of the catastrophic, unpredictable illness? That is the voluntary budget basis prepayment insurance plan, whether commercial, nonprofit, or Blue Cross Blue Shield type, where such coverage against catastrophic illness can now be obtained for the price of a package of cigarettes a day. This is the American way of helping people to help themselves. It is in opposition to an un-American way of doing all things for all people, the philosophy of give us this day our daily bread, baked in yeast and flour, courtesy of Washington, the philosophy of Washington is my shepherd, semicolon, I shall not want, period. At all events, the individual responsibility simply must be maintained. Now, in maintaining the individual's responsibility, we admit there are a tremendous number of new and untried devices. Tax-supported funds, the use of grants and aid, assistance to medical teaching and research, to education and the professional and allied sciences, hospital construction. As a matter of fact, the administration's bill, Senate Bill number 1679, its first six titles are rapidly on the way to becoming law now. This debate hinges entirely upon Title number 7, the compulsory tax sickness provision, where a 4% tax on income up to $4,800 a year would be levied. This would not raise a small percentage of the total amount needed to underwrite the cost of such a plan. Consequently, unless there is a more fair exposition thus far, we continue to oppose the government's compulsory program.
Thank you very much. Now, these gentlemen have very interesting views and quite as opposed to each other, I'm sure, as those we've already heard. But I think it would be nice if you would discuss together. Mr. Bimela, in Congress, I think you have a bill covering the same principles that have just been described. And I think if you would begin, perhaps Dr. Goyn, comes to us from Los Angeles, will break in and say what he thinks.
I'm very proud to be one of the House sponsors of the identical bill which Senator Murray, Senator Pepper, and others have in the Senate. We feel very strongly that the only way you can solve the problem of meeting the very high cost of medical care today is through a system of compulsory health insurance. We think on the basis of the AMA's own figures that it's pretty clear that 80% of the families in America cannot meet heavy medical costs in this country, and that there's no way to get them in. Now, if you're going to take, for example, voluntary plans, such as the one that Dr. Goyn heads up, for what he calls complete coverage, but which I frankly don't think is complete coverage, because you have to pay for the first two visits that you make to the doctor in any illness under Dr. Goyn's system in California.
Under Senator Murray's bill.
No, not under the present version, if you look at it carefully. But the point I want to make, Dr. Goyn, is that it costs $121.80 to get even this approximate complete coverage under your plan. Now, that's 12% of the income of a person making $1,000 a year. It's 6% of the income of a person making $2,000 a year. And I just don't think that low-paid American families can meet that kind of cost. So I don't think your voluntary plan begins to meet the problem.
Well, do you think, under any circumstances, the government should step in, Dr. Goins?
I take a very dim view of the heavy hand of government in the affairs of American personal life. I disagree with Mr. B. Miller. I think that people can afford medical care if they're only willing to rearrange their budgets. The American people paid nearly twice as much for alcohol last year as they paid for medical care. It's inconceivable to me that they couldn't do with a little less beer and a little more medical care. We can supply practically complete medical care. In spite of what Mr. B. Miller says, Section 735 of Title VII says that the board, which is in the five persons appointed by the president under the supervision of the Federal Security Administrator, shall make what rules and regulations it needs to make it function. And that would certainly include deducting some of the service whenever they find it necessary.
It might.
It certainly can.
But the bill doesn't say specifically that that's going to happen.
Of course
not. Your plan definitely does, as you know.
Of course not. All the bill can do is set up a skeleton. And thereafter, the so-called board, under the direction of the Federal Security Administrator, writes its own piece. The British health insurance law was only 25 or 30 pages long, but the Book of Rules and Regulations is 1,310 pages.
Of course, I think it's rather interesting, Long, you raised that question to point out that the British Medical Association was in favor of British health insurance, as Dr. Charles Hill told us recently, and the British Medical Association wishes they had something like the Truman Plan in operation instead of the socialized medicine scheme they have there.
Well, it would be better, but one leads to the other, of course.
No, I can't agree that one leads to the other. I think that those of us who are sponsoring the compulsory national health insurance bill are fighting every way we know how to stave off a socialized medicine plan, which is what you may get, Doctor, if you insist on going ahead with the blind opposition that the AMA is offering today to compulsory health insurance.
I know that you proponents of the bill, including Mr. Truman, remarked very virtuously that this is not socialized medicine, but that's just a play on words. It's socialized medicine within the general meaning of the terms in the minds of the American public. And in my own opinion, it's a definite and integral part of socialism, and the enactment of such a bill into law will be a definite step upon the dreary road that leads to the socialist state.
Well, it's very interesting that exactly that same argument, of course, was raised against the Social Security bill, against the Unemployment Compensation bill. It sounds so familiar that it's not even funny.
They're quite
applicable,
too.
I hate to see the AMA. In other words, you're opposed to the Social Security law and Unemployment Compensation.
Well, I think it's a gigantic fraud.
Well, there, of course, I can't agree with you at all, and certainly the American people don't think so. And Congress, Republicans and Democrats alike, are rushing these days to strengthen the Social Security law. I think the doctor has just told us, Mrs. Roosevelt, the actual philosophy of the American Medical Association. They're opposed to the kind of social insurance we have in America. They're opposed to old age pensions. They're opposed to unemployment compensation. Now, that's a logical position. Because all compulsory health insurance is taking the same idea that we have in Social Security and unemployment insurance and putting it on the cost of medical care.
You're going a little too fast, Mr. B. Miller. The American Medical Association is opposed to compulsory health insurance. Dr. Goins is opposed to the rest of it. He's a citizen. He just opposes the citizen.
Well, I'm just pointing out, though, the logic of your position, and I'm glad that you take it frankly, because at least it shows us where we stand on this issue.
Yes, but I do think that's an interesting point, because what we're trying to find out is, we've heard that 95% of the doctors agreed with the American Medical Association's position as taken in Massachusetts, but they haven't had an opportunity to express themselves on Dr. Goins' position.
Oh, no, well,
they've
don't
only had an opportunity to express themselves on the American Medical Association's position. So what would you say that was, if you'd add to that a little bit? We've heard one explanation, but if you'd add to that a little for the public.
Well, I think that more than 95% of all of physicians in America are violently opposed to compulsory health insurance.
You do.
Well, I don't know their attitude on these other things. I just rather ill-advisedly gave my own.
And now I'd like to ask Dr. Ben Moshe, who comes to us from Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, if he would give his views, comment on what he's heard.
I wish I had the opportunity to answer the doctor, the time, because the figures that I got from the County Medical Society are quite in variance with his figures, quite in variance. 12% voted and 88 out of every 100 did not vote for the $25 assessment. And now, my views are rather of a philosophical nature. As we've heard enough of the economics, the bill, Let me give you my personal views, Mrs. Roosevelt. I cannot subscribe to a national medical situation in which one doctor becomes rich in the practice of his profession and the next one remains poor, though they be equally good doctors. Even more strongly do I deplore a situation where a rich man can command complete protection for his health and a poor man cannot. It is my belief the time has come when the medical profession has got to realize its solid, sacred obligation to the public. What other body of men holds so completely the lives and the destinies of human beings in their hands as does the medical profession? Those who go into the study of medicine for what they themselves can get out of it are worse, far worse than quacks and charlatans. There have been, and there always will be, doctors who are a credit to their noble calling. Far too many of these whose idealism has been crushed by the shabby sordidness of what sometimes goes by the name of being practical. I well remember when I received my diploma a great many years ago, what the dean of the School of Medicine told us at that time. I quote, "You now receive this sheepskin, which symbolizes the 4 years of medical education that you received at the Medical College of Virginia. But we would like you to remember that this education which you have obtained is not yours to keep for your own ulterior aims, but is to be turned back as freely as you can give it to the public you shall serve. With regard to national health insurance, I feel that the rich man should pay and pay well to the doctor of his choice. But let the poor man have an equal chance of the same competent health. No man's health is more valuable than another's, though the size of their pocketbooks may differ. To me, this seems to be a keynote of all our thinking about our national health. If we have learned about the difficulties, flaws, and weaknesses in the panel system in Great Britain, let us not be discouraged, but remember that anything new and worthwhile is not easy. Let us benefit by their experienced mistakes and build a bulwark of sane, rational, national medical practice that will be equally beneficial to every member of the community and the medical profession as a whole." I wrote this from Mount Sinai Hospital about 4 weeks ago where I was very ill. I was surrounded by every medical attention and luxury. I could not be happy when I thought of the thousands and thousands whose need may be as great as mine who couldn't afford the very least of these luxuries. The present system must be changed, and the doctors must help to change it. I once said to a class of medical students, quote, "If God brings illness to human beings, he has also somehow in some way provided the remedy. Woe betide us if we of this generation neglect the responsibility to find the remedy to our present health problem." I may not, in fact, probably will not, be in accord with every radical change suggested by the present recommendations for national health medicine, but I am wholeheartedly in accord with the basic principles of a national health program.
Thank you very much, and I can't thank these gentlemen enough for the discussion that they have given us, but I see some other people that I think might like to say a word. I'm glad to see you, Dr. Boas. How are you? Well, have you got anything, any comment on what you've heard?
Yes, I'd like to first of all say that I favor national health insurance because I believe it is the only means of bringing adequate medical care to all the people. And if we agree that this should be done, it is the only way out. The organized medical profession, in their many million dollar campaign opposing this, has, to my mind, cast aside medical traditions and ideas.
Now I'd like a comment, too, from Dr. Rickert. And then you two can say things to each other. How to do, Dr. Rickert?
Well, I always feel that we are misdirected away from a fundamental fallacy that always takes place in these discussions, and that is that we always discuss these things when we're healthy. And everybody that has an opinion upon them is usually feeling swell. But if there's anything that I have learned as an ordinary practicing physician who sits at the bedside and holds people's hands while they're dying, It's that there's something that's fundamentally the same about a person who's sick. And that is that the one thing he wants is to be recognized as a person. He wants the doctor as a person. He wants an unhurried chance to talk to the doctor and tell his story and tell his symptoms and get something of personal reassurance and personal help from the doctor. And I feel that that's something that we have now, and I also feel that it's something that we're not going to have under any scheme such as is being proposed, where it's going to be hurried.
Well, now let's ask Dr. Boas whether under the scheme that he favors, that would be the case.
I'm confident it would be, but I don't like to make remarks without substantiation. And to emphasize my point, that the opposition hasn't always been quite fair, or at least that it reflects a certain basic point of view, I should like to quote very briefly from an editorial in the New York State Journal of Medicine of September, which says, "What does illness mean? Cowardice, malingering, laziness, maladaptation, cussedness, pure worthlessness. It is time that everyone should hoist Mr. Charles Darwin from his grave, blow life into his ashes so they could proclaim again to the world his tough but practical doctrine of the survival of the fittest." That is the attitude of organized medicine.
What would you like to say in closing on that?
Well, I don't know. I don't like to talk for the attitude of organized medicine because I'm not organized medicine. I'm just an ordinary doctor. I've sat at bedsides and talked to people, and the thing I'm worried about is not organized medicine or the doctors either. I'm worried about the patients. I want to know how they're going to take the kind of medicine that has been given them under schemes in other places. I don't think the American public is going to like it much.
Thank you very much, both of you, for your comments. Now, I have a surprise for our audience because I have asked someone who's had experience with both types. With a country where I think you have a very developed program under compulsory insurance, and then in this country. So now may I introduce Sister Kenny, who's done work here and done work in Australia, and I would just like to ask her to give us the results of her experience.
Thank you, Mrs. Roosevelt. It's a great pleasure to be here this afternoon, but I have listened with interest to the discourse. But the science of medicine knows no frontiers and should know no politics. It is the only science left that will bring about friendship throughout this troubled world. That has been my experience. I have been admitted into places where, owing to the fact that I belong to the medical profession in a small way, where the doors have been closed against everybody else because we had a gift of healing. And you cannot take away from the doctor the fact that he wants to excel in his profession. And if you take away if you remove the, well, what shall I say, competition, you do remove ambition. You stifle ambition. When you stifle ambition, you get retrogression. When you get retrogression, you get a poor medical profession. But I have great admiration for the doctor, and as I have said before, it is the only door that is open now throughout all kinds of political color throughout this world. That has been my experience. And I know that I have yet to meet the doctor that is not interested in humanity as a whole and the individual as his own special patient.
So that's a wonderful tribute to the doctors. But the point that we have particularly, of course, is the point of compulsory insurance or not?
Well, I don't like to mix in the politics of other countries
and rather not,
I don't belong to them.
I thank this audience for being with us today. Thank you very much.
These remarks, both for and against American adoption of a national health plan, were transcribed as Mrs. Eleanor Roosevelt was entertaining a group of friends and guests in her home, the Park Sheraton Hotel, New York City. Among those participating in this informal debate were Senator James E. Murray of Montana and Representative Andrew J. Weimiller of Wisconsin, who are among the sponsors of the National Health Bill in Congress. Dr. John F. Conlon of the American Medical Association, Dr. Lowell S. Goyne of Los Angeles, Dr. Moses Ben Moshe of Mount Sinai Hospital, Dr. Ernst P. Boas of the Physicians Forum, Dr. Philip Reichert, and Sister Elizabeth Kenny. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company. ¶¶
This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.